Well, thanks for coming, everyone. I'll read the first part and then we can read the text. So, as we saw last time, the Bhagavad Gita is an open text, open to different understandings, and we looked at Shankara's commentary on the opening verses of chapter 13. Now, Ramana, just some couple of hundred years later, writes a commentary on the same verses in complete contrast to Shankara's non-dualistic interpretation. Both are commenting on the notion of the self, the Atman, in the text that is so fundamental to all Indian philosophical debate. So before we launch into a reading of Ramanuja's commentary, I thought we'd take a few moments to reflect on the concept of the Atman, on the concept of the self in the history of Indian philosophy. So in Brahmanical discourse, the idea of the self and the quest to realise the self became perhaps the highest explicit value in Brahmanical society. There were other social values, of course, but that became a very important one. And there was a debate about which of the Purusharthas was the most important, Dharma, Karma, Artha, or Moksha, which is reflected in the Mahabharata. Now, a concern with the self was a philosophical preoccupation, and ascetic traditions developed that focused on the self in the belief that realising the self would free the practitioner or the ascetic from the bonds of suffering and reincarnation. The self lay hidden within the person, conceptualised in terms of a truth lying within the heart, and this truth is concealed and hidden, a secret that can only be discovered by the most discerning practitioner through long hours of contemplative practice. This self is the true reality, realising which one wakes up to the truth that frees us from the bonds of matter and reincarnation. That's in one view, anyway. The hidden inner self, Antaratman, the inner self, is an eternal truth, more real than the everyday reality that entraps us, but hidden in the depths of our being. To realise this hidden secret self is the highest goal of life in this Brahmanical tradition. And this knowledge, which is not simply a knowing that, a kind of knowledge, but a kind of knowledge that, not simply knowing that, a kind of knowledge that knows that the sky is blue or that three is a prime number, but rather this is an existential cognition involving a turnaround of the being of the person. And this liberation and life's highest and complete, this is liberation and life's highest and complete fulfillment. Now, the history of Hinduism could be read as the unfolding of this central idea, but of course things are more complicated, and that history is tied up with the history of society, politics, and other competing truth claims. Particularly that it is not the self that is found within the heart, but God. But one of the roots of Hindu traditions is the self, and the fundamental idea that through introspection, this hidden truth can be found. The truth within us is the truth of the self that never dies and was never born. In contrast to the unmoving, unchanging self, our action and the vicissitudes of everyday temporal life. The realisation of the self in the transcendence of action and its realm. So that's the realisation of the self is the transcendent, is going beyond action, going beyond karma and the realm of karma. And this idea can be located very early in the history of Hinduism in the Upanishads, and dates from at least 800 BC. Later, the idea of a distinct theistic reality is introduced by around the 2nd century BC, but the fundamental idea of the self hidden in the heart is never lost. This simple idea that within us, metaphorically conceptualized as hidden in the cave of the heart, we have a hidden deeper self that is our true identity, comes to be articulated through different genres of text, with different degrees of emphasis and different philosophical conceptions as to what this self is. The philosophy of the Vedanta, which is our main concern here, not in the centre but today, was concerned about the nature of the self and expressed a number of positions from the view that the self is, in the end, the only true reality, and is the same in all of us, to the view that there are innumerable distinct selves embodied in a real world. Other philosophies developed that our true self is distinct from matter, and the goal of life is to free ourselves from from its bonds, free the spirit from the bonds of matter. This Samkhya philosophy is one of the most ancient in India and has connections with Buddhism as well. Now, along with the philosophy of the hidden self, a social institution developed, devoted, at least theoretically, to this realization of the inner self, namely the institution of renunciation. We have strong debates about the nature of this self and how this inner truth can be reconciled, if at all, with life in the world, an obligation to family, clan, group and kingdom. And while philosophy comes to be centrally concerned with the nature of the self, there are popular genres of literature that are also contain the theme of the self hidden within and the quest for its realization. Indeed, the great epic about the Inter-Nicene War, the Mahabharata, ends with the hero Yudhishthira gaining final liberation after his long toil. Now, classical Hinduism, what we might call classical Hinduism, developed a range of philosophical accounts of the self, from the materialists who asserted the materiality and reality of the person as body, to Vedanta idealists who understood materiality to be unreal. The Upanishads themselves are the first text that espouse the idea of a hidden inner truth that is identified with the self. The Brihadaranyaka is the earliest text, about 800 BC, that presents the idea that the deepest reality hidden in the heart is the self, and furthermore this self is identical with the absolute self of the universe, with Brahman. Although there is a rhetoric of searching for the self within, this self, as Jonardhan Guneri points out, is not the object of consciousness, but the deepest subject. So although there's a rhetoric of you search for the self as if it's an object, it's actually not an object, it's the subject, it's the true subject. The perceiver cannot perceive itself and cannot be known in a conventional sense. About it, one can only say neti neti, no, not so. This idea developed in the Chandogya, where we find the famous story of how Aruni educates his son Shvetaketu into the truth of the self, how one should seek the essence of all things, and how the essence of the self constitutes the whole world. The very famous, that is what you are, Tattvamasi. As time develops, this idea comes to be modified in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, where we have the idea of God, of a God who is the focus of worship and yogic concentration, who is the source of the universe, a magician, the Mayi, who weaves the web of the world, Maya, and who is the substrate and support, Ashraya, of the self and world. He reigns over all the worlds and yet resides hidden in all beings, Sarvabhuta Guhashraya. So he's the support, which is Guha, which is hidden in all beings, Sarvabhuta. Towards the end of the first millennium BC, there was a massive expansion of Sanskrit learning and texts, as Pollock has documented in great detail, from the edicts of Ashoka, although they're not in Sanskrit, in the Mauryan dynasty. They're Prakrit, aren't they, the Ashoka? Yeah. So at a popular level, cultural level, by the end of the first millennium, Sanskrit literary culture began to develop with the gradual compositions of the great epics, the Ramayana and Mahabharata. Texts debated the four purposes of life: virtue, dharma, prosperity or wealth, artha, pleasure, karma and liberation, moksha, and which was of higher value. The Karma Sutra, 3rd century to 4th century AD, for example, discussed mostly erotic pleasure as expressing the fundamental nature of a person that had legitimate expression within the broader social context. This text was composed mostly for the high caste urbanite, the Nayaka, and points to a lack of inhibition that modern sensibilities, even in the West, are averse to. Teachings about pleasure, the Karma Sutra literature, Karma Shastra literature, articulated with a literary culture concerned with love, passion, beautiful women and handsome princes. The literary forms which later found expression in religious devotional literature, particularly in the poetry focused on Krishna. Alongside refined literary culture and the aestheticization of human experience, for the ruling elites in the urban environment, we have the development of literatures concerned with liberation and with raising of spiritual sensibilities that sought transcendence in the world. This kind of literature has liberation moksha, the search for the inner self, as its concern and a transcendence of worldly life. Thus, it is within the realm of renunciation, although increasingly the values of renunciation come to find a place within the values of the householder. So you've got these two sort of literary genres. You've got a literary genre concerned with liberation and renunciation, religious texts, we might call religious texts these days. You've got a text about aesthetics and how the Nayaka, how the cultivated urban young man should behave with regard to politics and pleasure and duty as well. So the Bhagavad Gita espouses the values of virtue, dharma, and the virtue of love, bhakti, for God, as the highest value beyond pleasure, beyond karma. The ideal human on his way to perfection should be without desire, detached from the fruits of action and offering those fruits to God in the text. The yogi who cultivates discipline is controlled, yukta, or steadfast, who has faith or confidence in the Lord and enters into the Lord. Texts on more intense forms of spirituality are being composed at the same time, such as Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, a synthesis of teachings about concentration practice that eradicates the traces of past action and prepares the self for final liberation, conceptualized as an inner solitude, Kaivalya. So I always think there are echoes of Plotinus, you know, the journey of the alone to the alone, is sort of echoed in Patanjali's text. Each monadic self is contained within itself in liberation, quite detached from the comings and goings of the world. This tech developed an intense sense of inwardness through concentration on a single point, ekagrata, that transforms consciousness. Consciousness takes the forms of its objects, so focusing on a pure, transcendent object, such as the Lord Ishvara, transforms the person to a level that transcends all limiting conditions and worldly constraints. This idea of the realization of inner self that transcends the outer self associated with the body is a theme that we find throughout the soteriological literature of classical and medieval periods. A rich tradition of yoga texts developed that cuts across sectarian divisions. Thus, for example, the Jain philosopher Hema Chandra can write a text on yoga, the Yoga Shastra, that echoes other traditions. The text makes a distinction between the inner self, the Antaratma, and the outer self, the Bahiratma. And the person who perceives himself to be the body is said to be external, Bahir, whereas the person who perceives the inner self as ruling over the body is full of bliss and has consciousness as its nature. So the yogin and the nayaka, then, both develop a focus on the self, the one expressing an ascetic value, the other an aesthetic value. Both the ascetic and the aesthetic were possibilities for the Brahmin householder, although the value of renunciation and transcendence arguably came to be the dominant paradigm. So, and all of these share this idea of a certain model of the mind that consciousness takes on the forms of its objects. So, wherever the mind goes, what you focus on, that's the shape of the mind, if you like. So there's even that. It's a bit similar to the medieval notion of extramission, that, the extramission idea was that consciousness was active, that perception was active, that a beam of light came out of the eye and touched things. So that's a similar sort of concept here. In fact, mrish, to touch, is actually used to perceive things sometimes, if I recall, in the Kashmiri context. So this is the idea that the mind goes out, attaches itself to objects, and perception is a kind of touching, and the mind takes on the form of its objects. So if the mind is attached to gambling or something, that's the form that the mind will take, but if you repeat a mantra, then the mind will take the form of that, so it raises the mind up to a higher kind of level. Now, it's within this context, a discourse of the self in terms of the purposes of life, in terms of pleasure, duty, and devotion, that the philosophers compose their commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. Now, Ramanuja, moving on to Ramanuja, He follows the philosophy of Vedanta, but disagrees with the non-dualist philosophy of Shankara that we looked at last week. Ramanuja's ideas, I'm sure you know, are qualified non-dualism, Vishishta Advaita, and Brahman is the only one perfect reality who is unchanging, but Ramanuja rejects Shankara's understanding of Maya as illusion. Brahman is unchanging, but its modes of expression are manifold. So he rejects Shankara's two levels of truth. He's a metaphysical and epistemological realist, really. And there's a distinction between God, selves, and world. And he presents a critique of idealism. The idealists such as the Buddhists, such as the Yogacara Buddhists, who were idealists, who said Chittamatra, there's only consciousness. And also the Hindu, the Vedantin non-dualists, such as Shankara. He doesn't seem to respond to... He mentions Shaivas, but he doesn't seem to respond to them. I'm not sure why, because they were quite powerful at that time as well. Now, for Ramanuja, Brahman is God, is a theistic reality, and he makes that distinction between God in his Svarupa, in his essence, and God in his Vibhuti, or his powers, if I remember. And you can know God in his vibhuti, but you can't know God in his svarupa, in his essence. So the self participates in that liberation in God, but only within in his vibhuti, but not in his svarupa, which is beyond, which is wholly transcendent and inconceivable, achintya, I suppose. And ineffable. So the soul then can understand God and in his powers in as having and you can as in his approachability in his salabhya, and you can approach God in certain ways, and that's how you can understand him as a child, as a parent, as a lover, and the four categories of a friend, the four categories of relationship. Now, he writes a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, and of the three paths that he highlights, the Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, and Jnana Yoga, Bhakti, he says, is the highest. It's interesting, though, if you look at the actual Gita, the term Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga, they hardly occur. I mean, Buddhi Yoga occurs more times than Jnana Yoga, for example, the term Buddhi Yoga. Karma Yoga, I think it occurs once, I think, the actual word. I'd have to check. But so it's interesting how those three have fallen out of the text and get highlighted by the commentators, by the later commentators. And he's concerned with Upasana, worship of the Lord in his image form, in his archavatara in the temple. And he's interested in prapati, which is surrender to the Lord. And the purpose of creation is to glorify God. The souls are similar to God, but not identical, and liberation is to be united with God and free from karma, but not identical, not merging with God, because there's an ontological difference between the self and the Lord, a bridgeable ontological difference. So you've got to understand Shankara, I think, as a practicing, it's like the Archbishop of Canterbury or something like that. He's got Sri Rangam Temple to run, and he's got the whole community to administer and care for. But he's got this philosophical dimension to his work as well. So the philosophical work has got to be seen in the context of Upasana, which is worship of the image form of the Lord in the temple. Now, we got the commentary in front of us from this is from Ramanuja's Sri Bhashya on chapter 13, The Field and the Field Knower. So I thought we'd see if we can make any sense of it. So there's the verse. Have you got this?
You have to hear Shankara.
Oh, yeah, but you got the verse, verse 2, sorry. Verse 2 is idam shuriran kanteya kshetram iti abhidiyate etadyo vetitam prahu kshetragnya iti tad vida. So this idam shiriram, this body, O son of Kunti, kshetram iti abhidiyate, is known as the field. And one who knows it is said to be the field's knower, kshetragnya, by those who know. And then we, on the next page, you've got Ramanuja's commentary. So let's read the first sentence. Purvasmin shadke parama prapyasya parasya brahmano bhagato vasudevasya prapti upaya bhuta bhakti rupa bhagavad upasananga bhutam praptuhu pratyagatmano yatapmya darshanam jnana yoga karma yoga lakshanishta dvaya sadhyam uktam. Well, in Purvasmin Shadke, in the previous six chapters, the attainment of the inner self, pratyag atmana, I think pratyag atmana, pratyag can mean inner, according to the dictionary. So I've interpreted pratyag atmana as inner. Of the inner self, the attainment of the inner self, so I guess that's a genitive, as being ancillary to the worship of Lord Vasudeva, as being an anga to the upasana, to the worship of Bhagavad, who is the highest absolute, the supreme attainment. And this was taught. Oh dear. So let's go that last bit before we go back. This was uktan. This was sadhyam. This is to be brought about through the dvaya, through the two practices, I guess, which are characterized as jnana and karma yoga. So that achievement, that absolute, is to be brought about by those two practices of jnana and karma. Or that darshanam, that vision into the self, the atmya darshanam. Something like that. Now let's should we go over this again? It's quite difficult, isn't it? Can everyone see where we are? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Purvasmin Shatke, in the previous six chapters, and we've got these genesis, Paramaprapasya, Parasya, Brahmano, Bhagato, Vasudevasya, and then this long compound, Prapti Upaya Bhuta Bhakti Rupa Bhagavad Upasananga Bhutam. Praptu. So in the previous six chapters, the attainment of the inner self, I think, which is being ancillary to the law, is ancillary to the worship of Lord Vasudeva. So in the previous chapters, it was talking about the worshipping Lord Vasudeva, but the attainment of the self was ancillary to it, part of it, but not the main thing, if you like. So now it's going on to talking about the self as the main thing. So Lord Vasudeva is the highest god who you're worshipping with in Upasana and so on.
Yeah, the Sri Krishna.
Hmm?
Sri Krishna.
Yes, yes, Vasudeva,
what
Sri Krishna.
What is the past sixth chapter? This is from the Gita.
Yeah.
So this is the seventh chapter, isn't it?
This is the 13th chapter. This is the 13th chapter. So
That's the Bhakti Yoga.
This is the field and the field knower, Kshetra, Kshetrajna. Chapter about the self and the world and the relationship between self and God. And it's chapter 13. But he says the previous six chapters, which... he says that have been concerned about God. What was before the previous six?
What is the Krishna showing the world inside, the universe inside the mouth?
That's in chapter 11.
That is after 11.
Yeah, that's right.
After 11.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The I think the sixth chapter is Karma Yoga.
That's right. The sixth chapter is on yoga.
Yoga, Karma Yoga. And Grand Yoga is in I think fifth.
I can't remember where they occur now. That's right. There are six chapters on yoga. So,
yoga, yeah.
But after, I mean, he's referring here from chapter 7 to 12, isn't he? The previous six.
7 to 12, that's correct.
So
11th is showing the universe inside the mouth.
Vishwarupa, that's right. Vishwarupa. The universe, yes. Yes. And Arjuna asks Krishna to go back to his human
form.
What
is it?
That's right.
Human, yeah.
Yeah. So that's chapter 11, that is.
So he was frightened.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's all included. So that's all about the Bhagavan. That's all about Vasudeva.
Oh, who is Ramanujan, by the way? Ramanujan is coming. Which century, Ramanujan?
He's 11th century. I can't remember his date. Do you remember
11th
his
century.
10 something. He's said to have lived for 120 years.
Yes, I think he's supposed to have lived very old. Yes, yes. But about 11th century. In contrast to Shankara, who died very young.
Oh, Shankara.
I'm not completely sceptical of someone living that long, who knows.
No.
Some of these yogis, you know. I think that's the gist of that, anyway. Perhaps let's carry on reading the thing. So, and then the next chapter is the Madhyamecha, and then we've got this very long thing here, which we'll see how we get on with Madhyamecha. Parama prapya bhuta bhagavat tattva yatapmya tan mahapya jnana purvakai kantikat yantika bhakti yoga nishta patipadita. Madhyamecha. Parama prapya. Everyone follow it. Can everyone follow it? See where we are, Madhyamecha. Mm-hmm. Next, Paramprapya Bhuta Bhagavat Tattva.
Tat Tanmasya.
Yatamya Tanmahapmya Jnana Purvakai Kantikat Yantika Bhakti Yoga Nishta Patipadita. Then carrying on, Ati Chaitaishvarya Apekshanam Atma Kaivalya Matra Pekshanam Cha Bhakti Yogastad Tad Apekshita Sadhanam Iti Choktam. Ooh, saved by the bell. Nope. Okay.
Don't do that, Jessica.
Oh, yeah, come in. We haven't got a spare one now. Oh, I got it on my computer, so you can take that one. Yeah. So, Madhyame Cha and Madhyame in the middle verses. Is explained. What is explained in the middle verses? Oh. Uktam is explained. All this is explained in the middle verses. That there is sorry, I'm just reading over it.
I don't see the uktam.
Cha uktam.
Then it goes with para all the way down here. Yeah, chop them. Okay.
Yeah, see the chop down there, and then
might be easier if we start with the pratipadita.
Okay. Oh yes, because there's a yes, of course. Yes. So, and in the middle of verses, so is it skill? I guess a pretty skill in the practice, the yoga of devotion, accompanied by. Jnana, accompanied by knowledge of His Majesty, something like that. The truth of the Lord being the supreme goal.
Yeah, you have Madhyacha in the middle six chapters.
Yeah.
Bhakti Yoga Nishtha, the sort of steadiness or pursuit of Bhakti Yoga is Pratipadita.
Yes.
Is established.
Is established.
And that Bhakti Yoga is Ekantika and Atyantika. It's sort of one pointed.
One pointed, yes. One pointed.
Atyantika. Ultimate. And that's then Purvaka preceded by Jnana.
Yeah, preceded by Jnana.
Of Mahatmya, of the greatness, which is Yathatmya.
Yep.
Which is the true greatness.
Yes.
Of the Tattva, of the nature, of Bhagavat, of the Lord, who is Paramaprapya Bhuta.
Yes, who is Paramaprapya.
Supreme thing.
Supreme thing. Yeah, good.
It's very, very typical Ramanuja, long compound.
Yep. Also, I guess, also, it is taught. I guess by the superior ones or something, that the practice of devotion, the bhakti yoga, the practice of the bhakti devotion. Is the method for those seeking power and for those seeking only the isolation of the self, or something like that. Atma Kaivalya Matra Pekshanam. So for those only seeking Kaivalya of the self, isolation of the self, Bhakti Yoga is the method. And for those seeking Aishwarya, those seeking power, so I'm just looking something up. So I think you've got two things there. You've got those who are seeking Aishwarya and those seeking Atma Kaivalya. And in the what do you reckon? Do you reckon that's about that?
Yeah. Deshikaina's sub-commentary, he quotes the Gitartha Sangra of Yamanacharya, which is, seems to Ramanuja's paraphrasing here, where he says that in bhakti yoga stadarti dos, who desire the Lord, and in bhakti yoga there would be after Aishwarya, and atmarti dos, who desire the self, there one. So it takes them as two different ones.
Good. So I'm just trying to find my. So it goes on. So I'm just finding the place here. The text has run away with me for a minute. Yeah, idanim. Uparitanashke Prakriti Purusha Tat Samsarga Rupa Prapancheshvara Varayatat Atmya Karma Jnana Bhakti Svarupa Tad Upadana Prakarascha. Shatkadvayodita Vishodhyante. So let's have a look at that. Now, in the middle, the subsequent six chapters. In two groups is taught the nature of matter, the self and their relation, I guess. Prakriti. So the Purusha, the self, Prakriti, matter. And their relation. The expansion of the universe. The Lord, the true nature of action, knowledge and devotion, and ways of practicing them. Tatra tavat trayodashe deha mano svarupam dehaya tatmya shodanam deha vyuktatma prapyupaya viviktatma svarupa san shodanam tata vidasyatmana cha chit sambandha hetuhu tato vive kanusandana prakarash chochate idamiti. My word. So, here in the 13th chapter, the nature of soul and body, the clarification of the true nature of the body, the clarification of the nature of the detached self, and the cause of the conjunction of unconscious matter with the self, and the type of inquiry into discrimination between self and matter are taught. So the viveka, the discrimination between what is the self and what is not the self. Let's just get on to the last bit I want to look at. In the next page, finally, we've got idam shariram devoham manushyoham stuloham krishoham ityatma boktra saha samadhi karanyena pratiyamanam bokturatmano apmano artantara bhutasya bhogakshetramiti sharira yatatmya vidyir avidiyate etat avayavasha sanda tarupena cha idam aham vedmi iti yo veti tam vedya bhutad asmad vaidi tridvenar tanantara bhutam kshetraknya iti tadvidaha apmyatma vya vida prahu. So idam shariram, this body, which is associated with the experiencing self and cognized in conjunction with terms or sentences such as devoham, I am God, manushyoham, I am a man, stuloham, I am fat, I am thin, is considered by those who know the true nature of the body to be the field of experience of the experiencing self. And so to be quite different. Those who know the true nature of the self call it the field knower. The experiencer who knows it, i.e. the body, comprising separate limbs, as well as altogether as an assemblage, can say, I know it. Idam aham vedmi, I know it as object. And one who knows this is called the Kshetrajna, the knower of the field. He's a difficult writer, Ramanujan, isn't he? You've got all these long compounds together. But I think we've got a general sense. We're just vaguely glossing it. I think that's a general sense of what he's talking about. So for him, then, as opposed to Shankara, the self, as this commentary makes clear, is quite distinct from the body and also from the Lord, who is its highest object. And it's just interesting to contrast this commentary with the one we looked at last time by Shankara, which is actually much easier to read as well, but where you've got the Shankara's going out of his way to make the self identical with the Lord. Okay, so I'm going to stop, I think.
This is the Gita's explanation by the two people differently, Shankaracharya and Ramanujan.
That's right, yes. So Shankara, we looked at last time, he's got his own commentary on the same verses, and we're contrasting it with Ramanujan's commentary.
And Shankara, which century?
He's 8th century.
8th and 11th century.
Yeah. So 300 years difference, almost, 300.
It's interesting that this sort of division of the Gita in these three parts, in the first six chapters, the middle and the last six, that the Yamuna comes up with and then Ramanuja sort of re-articulates here. In many ways it has shaped the way people have thought about the Gita for centuries up until the modern period. Like Vivekananda with his Karma Bhakti and Jnana Yoga books.
Of course. Yeah. So it comes from their divisions. Shankara's the first one, is he to divide it in that way? Probably, I can't remember.
I don't remember Shankara doing it, but Yamuna, Ramanuja's sort of guru of his guru, is the first one to do it, I think.
He divides it into the three sections. Yeah.
And then Aurobindo and Vivekananda explain differently also.
Yes, Aurobindo wrote a commentary on the Gita.
And the Vivekananda also.
Did Vivekananda write a commentary? He may have done, not sure.
Aurobindo
did. Did Tilak? Tilak wrote a commentary, I think. Gandhi was. I don't think he wrote anything, did he? On Gita?
No, one of his disciples.
One of his disciples, yeah.
Wrote something based on him.
But it's an interesting text that has echoes and resonance even today. I think it was an important text even in Shankara's time. It has to be important for them to bother to write a commentary on it.
So. Indeed.
And it's echoed through the centuries. There's an excellent book come out by Shruti Kapila and Faisal Devji on the influence of the Bhagavad Gita on the modern world, on Tilak and Aurobindo and Gandhi. So it's very well worth reading that CUP. And if you can't get it, it's in modern the papers are a reprint really of Modern Intellectual History journal.
Who is Shruti Kapila, by the way?
She's in Cambridge. She teaches South Asian history, Cambridge. And Faisal Debji's here. Yeah, teaches history here. Yeah. Oh, you saw him the other day. Yeah. So that's it, folks. Thank you for coming. Thank you very much for attending on a rainy afternoon. And we've looked at these two commentaries on the self in the Gita.
I made a Plotinus reference. What was the text?
The Enneads. I can't remember which one. Journey of the Alone to the Alone.
Journey of the Alone to the Alone. Okay. I don't know if I have
that's
funny. That's what life is. Journey of the Alone to the Alone.
Journey of the Alone to the Alone.
Very melancholic, really.
Often I've heard one person describe that to be alone is to really be all one.
To be alone is
alone
to be all one.
All one.
Well, I suppose it is, isn't it? All one.
Plotinus, that was what he would have meant.
Probably, it's a paradox. One. Yeah, one, oneness, yeah. Of course, although it's a journey of the alone to the alone, there's nowhere to go, is there? For Plotinus, it's just.
Isn't that what Henry Corbin says about Sufism?
Probably.
About Ibn Arabi or something like that. That it's always the journey of the alone to the alone. That's the strange place of kind of
pantheistic thought. It's very resonant, that whole idea goes into romanticism and so on, the journey of the alone to the alone.
Makes life sound so interesting.
It does. Might be true, mightn't it? Might be true.
Mm.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming, and see you again soon.